Hey guys, real quick, we wanted to do a huge spoiler alert for this episode. So if you want to see Hereditary without spoilers, you might want to skip this one.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I am Jeremy Fisk, and this week I am joined by Chapin Hemingway and Lee Carlo.
Good morning.
Yeah. So we were able to go and see the film Hereditary in theaters this week. It is a movie about a matriarch, a grandmother who has died before the film has started, and through the grieving process, there's this family that sort of gets torn apart by some mysterious happenings.
Literally and figuratively.
Come on, Peter. Here's your suit.
It's heartening to see so many strange new faces here today. I know my mom would be very touched and probably a little suspicious. My mother was a very secretive and private woman.
It's Grandma. You know you were her favorite, right?
Even when you were a little baby, she wouldn't let me feed you because she needed to feed you. She was a very difficult woman, which maybe explains me.
I recognize you from your mother.
What? Sometimes I swear I can feel them in the room.
Oh my God! What was that?
She isn't gone.
She had private rituals, private friends.
Who's gonna take care of me?
You don't think I'm gonna take care of you?
But when you die.
She wasn't altogether there. At the end.
So this is Ari Aster's first feature film. He's directed a bunch of shorts before, but he got the helm of a feature film this time, starring Toni Collette. And successful tone and pacing are sort of like the hallmarks of the horror genre. And I feel like how you like your horror genre is almost an individual preference, like something unique to maybe just horror and comedy. You know, some people prefer jump cuts, some people like overt violence, some people like implied violence, some people like a slow, meticulous burn. Some people just like it to be a little creepy. All of these are tools that a director can play with. And here, Ari Aster, the director in Hereditary, we got the sort of slow burn, creepy pacing. So my question to you guys is, what's your favorite flavor of horror? And where does Hereditary land on that scale?
Well, go ahead, Jaden.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Lee. Go ahead.
Well, I prefer the kind of methodical, you know, very intentional tone movie that a lot of Hereditary is. You know, that kind of implication of danger and the you know, what's lurking around the corner strategy. I think that's what works for me. I think it requires better filmmaking and more interesting filmmaking. And yeah, I mean, I think the, you know, the, I don't know that it's like scary, like jump out of your seat scary and you scream, but I think what works so well about that style of horror is you're kind of always on the edge of your seat because you're not, you're ready for something new to happen, or you're at least your imagination is kind of creating something that's going to happen, which can always be new and fresh, as opposed to some of like the old conventional horror techniques that you kind of always expect in that other style of horror.
Yeah, I think we talked a little bit back on the Annihilation podcast about the emotion of dread. I don't know. I mean, if that's an emotion, maybe that's just a description of an emotion. But I think that one of the things that maybe you're talking about, Jeremy, is this idea of dread. And I find that very intriguing in movies. I found it very that to be one of the few things I liked about Annihilation. But I do think that this movie, and I felt that in Hereditary as well. And I think one of the reasons why this movie is getting such good reviews, it's got like an 87 on Metacritic, is it isn't that sort of jump scare traditional way of going about horror movies. But I do think that that feeling of dread, it builds, and it plays off itself, and it gets bigger, and it expands, and I think that there's a sort of a critical mass to how much dread you can kind of take at one point. And I think I don't know, it might be better suited for a shorter film, but that's no judgment on Hereditary. I just think that sometimes it can be kind of a limited resource, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and to answer my own question, I personally in horror movies do kind of like the slow burn, that sort of feeling of dread you're alluding to, Chapin, as long as there is a payoff that works in the end.
Sure.
Because for this movie is slow at times, like just plain out slow. Like I felt myself getting bored, but I'm like, just give it time. It's building to something. And for me, what it was building to was really kind of a disappointment. It was a bit, did you guys find it a bit messy at the end? I mean, I don't need any sort of like clean resolution in something that's about the occult and whatever, demons or Satan or whatever they're, you know, dealing with. But I don't know. It didn't have enough of an impact at the end there for me to justify the whatever hour I was getting bored.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it fell apart at the end. I know we're sort of jumping ahead here, but I guess that's okay. You just brought it up. I mean, I don't agree with you about the boredom. I had this feeling that when I, you know, knowing that I was going to see this for the podcast, I when I left the movie, my first reaction thinking about what we were going to talk about here was that this might have been the movie I've been most sort of engaged with on a minute by minute basis of all the movies we've seen for the podcast. But yes, I mean, I think that being said, I mean, you know, we could and explore different levels of engagement, and, you know, engagement over fear, you know, may not be the most, you know, captivating sort of engagement, but I totally agree with you, Jeremy. Like, this movie fell apart at the end. And like, what I thought was interesting is, like, we can talk about Ari Aster as a director later in a little bit, but I think one of the things that stuck out to me about at least his shots and the way he directs horror is he leaves things in the frame that you don't notice right away, right? I mean, there mm-hmm. is some very famous shots, and there's things that I noticed and that I don't think a lot of other people notice, and I'm not usually very good at seeing those things, and I think I saw them before a lot of people in the theater saw them, and they were extremely frightening, and sort of discovering them in his frame makes it even more scary. It's almost scary. It's a different kind of scary than the sort of jump scare we've been accustomed to seeing in movies of this genre. But I kind of wanted that in the movie. I kind of wanted to I wanted that on a macro scale. I wanted to discover what this movie was about. And at the mm-hmm. end, it really just kind of explained everything to you in a bit of a sloppy way. And the payoff just wasn't there. It wasn't interesting enough to sort of justify all this, like, you know, I think very good filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, especially with that sort of antithesis of the jump scare. It was almost like a slow jump scare with a lot of those shots you're referencing, because it is really unique, and it's really a credit to the filmmaking to be able to have a frame and then let that frame live. And by the end of that little scene, you get a scare out of it when you don't put anything new into it. It's really kind of amazing.
I think this movie is guilty of more than just losing you at the end and the payoff. And I, interestingly enough, it's because of the end, because I give Astor a lot of credit for some of the scenes that he did, like some great suspense, you know, some really good filmmaking, some great camera work throughout. But in the end, I left giving him no credit, because I just felt like this is another rookie director that's making his name with the horror genre that he knows is going to fill seats. And like, he's got some talent and there's some well done scenes. And as a result, I think he fell into some good reviews. But you know, to a certain extent, I think people are getting suckered by some of these scenes. Like this movie went so far off the rails, and I read an interview with the director who said that was totally intentional. And all I'm thinking while I'm reading it, I'm like, that's a bad thing. What you did with this movie was a bad thing.
What do you mean off the rails? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, I mean, it's a slow burn, like we were describing, and then it just like launches into this, you know, all these conventional cheap scare tactics that we see in a million horror movies. And you know, that's when the audience that I was seeing the movie with started jumping and like making noise and like, you know, laughing because they don't know how else to react. And I'm just sitting there watching it. I'm like, he lost me, completely lost me. And I was like, you know, he had something going. But as a whole, I give this movie very little credit because of the direction he took it. And that's why I say it's guilty of more than just losing me in the end, because there was nothing that justified that final act.
So what would have been the answer? I think we all agree that this movie sort of fell apart in the end. After an interesting, maybe for me it's slightly boring, but an interesting slow burn of a movie. But what's the answer to this? How?
Well, that's part of the problem. I wrote down all these like questions that you know never got answered. And you know, the first one that comes to mind, and it's not even really a question, but it's a flaw with the movie, is like how Annie, Toni Collette's character, kept like thinking she had the puzzle solved. Like, she thought she could burn the book, and then that didn't work. And then she was like, it's my fault, you need to kill me, and then that's it. But and then it turns out at the end, no, has nothing to do with that. Now she's, you know, up in the attic cutting her head off, spoiler alert, which made no sense. And like, you know, why all of a sudden does her husband burn alive? And why is Charlie running around the house? Is it really Charlie? Is it Ghost? Like, none of that stuff made sense. But they were still trying throughout the movie to like hint at the answers throughout this slow burn. Like, they were starting to have the characters solve the puzzle, but every time she thought she was solving the puzzle, it turned out that their solution had nothing to do with what was actually going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of none of it mattered at the end, right?
Like, right.
The rules that were sort of established by the movie, more or less, or what we thought were the rules, were meaningless by the end. It was this was going to, it seemingly on the film's own admission, this was going to happen. The ending was going to happen regardless. And so, yeah, I mean, it makes her efforts, Toni Collette's efforts, seem kind of meaningless, but I don't know. I mean, maybe that's part of the movie. Maybe that's intentional. I don't know. I mean,
well, then that's really poorly done if that was intentional, because what you could do to sort of answer your question, Jeremy, is tie them in some way, shape, or form. Like, you know, have some of the, you know, ideas or revelations that Annie feels like she's having, and like trying to understand what's happening to her family. Have those tie in some way. If you want to have this, you know, cult ending, make that work, tie those things together, and it doesn't happen. And
right, and like, what was the cult even trying to accomplish? What did they get out of this whole thing?
Right, and they try to hint at some history of it, like she's flipping through her mother's old books and stuff.
Right,
and,
but what did they ultimately achieve? I don't know, really.
Well, what really frustrated me is and I don't normally do it, but I did look through some reviews on this, and you know, you got people talking about all the clues that are left throughout the movie. You know, the symbol that's on the phone, on the telephone pole. You know, the symbol's also up in the attic that represents this demon god or whatever. And my reaction to that is just like, if you're going to delve into the supernatural, of course the clues are going to work. Anything can work.
Yeah.
So don't give this movie credit for planting all these clues when you just launch into this like storyline where you can be like, oh yeah, because that's the demon symbol and that's the demon's ghost. And like, of course it's going to work.
Yeah. And it's right, almost, like, oh, go ahead.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, to your point about the phone pole, I mean, there was the symbol, the cult symbol was on the phone pole that decapitated the young girl. But I mean, what does that mean? I mean, did they put the animal there? Like, I mean, that's like magical realism, right? Like they somehow engineered this pole to be there just at the right place to have to decapitate this poor girl. And yeah, I mean, it's like they are, the cult seems to be like, beyond the sort of normal world, right? Like they have control to do things that are beyond the realm of realistic, right? And so it makes it inherently less interesting, right?
Yeah. And what's frustrating is that like all of these problems exist because of where the movie went, and it did in many ways ruin the movie for me, because I think Ari Aster's clearly got some talent. There was some masterful work done in this movie. The Charlie's death scene, it was incredible. That's the best scene I've seen all year, the way he did that. And how Peter doesn't want to look. Is Peter the son or is that the father? Alex Wolf character doesn't want to look in the mirror to see what happened because he knows what happened. And then
he just goes right to bed.
And he just goes to bed. Yeah. I just thought that was so, so good. That scene was perfectly done. And so that's where I give him credit. And I'm like, this is a good filmmaker. That could have been a short film. But I just feel like this is a guy that wanted to make a horror movie. You know, it's the same reason he had, you know, he felt like he really wanted to cram in that Joni Mitchell song at the end to juxtapose the like, horrible ending with this sort of, like, you know, melody. And I'm like, the song doesn't really make sense there, but like, it was just something he wanted to do. And I just feel like it's rookie mistakes that this movie was full of.
Sure. Okay. But let me ask you this, like, and this might get into our next conversation a little bit, and I'll try not to, but, I mean, what more do you want? I mean, why do you want anything more from this kind of movie? I mean, I guess that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a movie, did it transcend the genre or not? And, you know, the idea is, from the reviews, is maybe it did, but I mean, maybe it didn't, but maybe it's just really scaring me. I had the shit scared out of me for most of this movie. And well, I mean,
Well, to answer your question in a sort of roundabout way is like where I want to give this movie credit, because it was a slow burn and it was asking those questions. Your engagement level had to be sort of on point. And when your engagement levels, when you're trying to figure stuff out, yeah, exactly. Did somebody just do that clicking noise?
No.
So, well, I'll get to a story about that too. So when your engagement levels, like where it is for this movie, when you're trying to figure out all these questions, this sort of, I don't know what the right word for it is other than creepiness, sort of gets into your psyche in a way, and it does affect you and it does frighten you in a totally different way than, say, like an ultra violent or a jump scare movie does. And how I know it did was because, even though I had all that disappointment about the movie in the end, and I thought it really didn't affect me walking away, that night, apparently in the middle of the night, Sarah wakes me up and starts pushing me. She's like, "Stop doing that!" And I'm like, "What?" And apparently, I was doing.
Oh my god!
In the middle of the night. So,
did you see it with her? Was she totally freaked out?
And yeah, I saw it with her, and she's like, at the time, she thought I was doing it on purpose. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, she's like, stop doing that. And I'm like, what? She's like, you're clicking. And I'm like, oh, that's weird.
I had trouble sleeping too. I mean, it got to me somehow.
That's what I mean. It creeps into your psyche because it does ask all these questions, even though those questions turn out to be irrelevant in the end. Maybe it doesn't matter if I'm clicking in the middle of the night and Chapin's not sleeping. Something was effective here.
This movie had no impact on me after I left the theater.
Mr. Big Shot over
no,
here.
No, honestly, like, it
oh, I'm
has,
so tough.
No, it has nothing to do with that. It is literally because of how frustrated I was with where he went with this movie. If this movie continued on the path that it was, then that clicking noise becomes so much more impactful. But in the end, it was literally a catalyst to the jump scares later.
Well, that's how I felt when I left it. But obviously, it got to me more than I thought it did. On some sort of level.
But like what's so aggravating is things like that. When the movie is all said and done, you realize was just a catalyst to the jump scares later, so that Peter's hearing it, and then. You know, and then you start to look at that first half of the movie, the first 2/3 of the movie, where there's good filmmaking, and you start to question other aspects. So if Charlie is supposedly a demon, like the whole time, is possessed by this demon, then why is she allergic to peanuts? Like, that doesn't, like, like all these...
I mean, I didn't really even think about that, but I did have that
question. Are the problems that I started to have, because... I was trying to start to connect the dots. I'm trying to say, okay, how is the beginning of this movie leading into the end? So I start looking at all these little pieces, right. And I'm realizing they don't actually play any part.
But I think the fact that we're all looking at all these pieces and trying to put it together is how the movie becomes so effective. Yeah, like taking the end out of it, I think the reason the first 2/3 of the movie worked is because you are questioning everything in a weird way. Even Millie Shapiro, who played Charlie, that young girl, like, she has a very unique look. And you're wondering kind of where is, like, why cast her in this? I mean, she was really good, but those questions get brought up in your head that are just like, okay, so she definitely has this, like, very specific look. Is that trying to say something? Is she supposed to be, like, at the end, is there some sort of payoff? Where maybe she was a demon the whole time, or maybe she was, like, I don't know. It, like, every little layer of it sort of made me question things. And then, of course, at the end, you're just like, okay, I guess none of it mattered.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, though. Like, you're at, like, all these questions come up, and none of them are answered. That's a bad thing in this case. Like,
I agree, but I'm just saying it. I agree, it is a bad thing, and if it had pulled it off at the end, it would have been this amazing horror movie. But I think I think it's just interesting as a filmmaker that you can engage on a horror creepy level by questions, by having your audience question things, and that sticks into their brain. I think that's really interesting, and I would have loved to see this pay off in a better way.
Well, and that's why I'm frustrated, because it was done well, and I actually would have preferred, Chapin, you brought up Annihilation, I would have preferred an Annihilation-style ending to this movie than what he did, because with a movie like Annihilation, you know, whether it's good or bad or makes sense, at least, you know, at least you feel like there is something there that Alex Garland was trying to do that was unique and, you know, work all his pieces together. Where here, Aster just made two movies. He made, you know, this kind of slow burn, edgy your seat on pins and needles horror movie, and then he just made the same horror movie we've seen and critiqued a million times, and one didn't have anything to do with the other.
Well, I think that's a good transition into our next segment.
Well,
okay,
real...
now you got, now Jeremy sounds real quiet.
Does that sound any better? I just put it up.
Yeah.
Okay. Especially Toni Collette, but a lot of the actors are getting a lot of credit in this movie.
I do want to talk about Toni Collette, because I think this was the Toni Collette show. I mean, she got to do a whole range of emotions and interesting things. I bet it, as an actor, it was a challenge, but I bet it was somewhat fun too. I mean, she really got to let go on this, and I think she was amazing. I mean,
really?
Yeah, I thought she was amazing, but I almost felt it was weirdly a little showy, if that makes any sense. Like, yeah. She was really good, but like she was showing off some skills that you were kind of like, okay, we get it.
Yeah, she's got one of those faces that, I'm going to try to put this lightly, like you get annoyed with how scared she is. Like, she has a very emotive face. Mm-hmm. And I remember this from The Sixth Sense too. Like, she kind of, you can like see her like whining and kind of like falling apart in her face, like the way she kind of like pulls and twists her face. I think it can be very effective, but it also feels like I don't know that overacting is the word, but it feels like it's not subtle. I'll just say that.
Like, it feels like you're seeing her perform. It feels like you see her act. And yeah. I think it was effective in this particular movie. Lee may disagree, it sounds like, but I definitely felt like there are points where I'm like, whoa, she's putting on a show here.
Yeah, I think all of the performances were more on the side of bad than good. None of them were distractingly so. Alex Wolff's was a bit distracting, which I don't blame him at all. That was a difficult role to play. But Collette, I don't think she was great in this movie. I thought, you know, she had the big blow up scene at the dinner table, which was well done. But everything else seemed so forced. Like, she didn't feel natural to me, and it did feel like she was acting, and like almost like this thing she was saying, she was trying to convince herself of, which, you know, maybe was the intention, but I didn't feel like it came off well. Millie Shapiro, I thought was like nothing special. And Gabriel Byrne, supposedly there was an hour of this movie that was cut out of the first draft or the first cut. Wow. And it was like mostly of like the family and stuff. And that was because Ari Aster felt like that was an important element to like establish his family, which is true. Those were some of the better parts of the movie. But I'm wondering if maybe that was where Gabriel Byrne's personality was.
That's a good point. On the cutting room floor, he was pretty blasé.
Like, God, another one of these like comatose husbands that just like doesn't know what to do or say. I'm like, enough. Like, and this will lead into the question I want to ask you. Like, some of the reviews I read are just giving like Gabriel Byrne all this credit for like having so many layers to his character, and like the family so well developed. And I'm like, please, like. And Toni Collette, I was not convinced by her, and again I saw, you know, that, and you guys seem to like her in it, but it's an actress I like. But
Toni Collette, is she attractive or not? She's one of those people. Am I attracted to her or not?
Excellent question.
Yeah, you know what,
depends on the day.
United States of Tara, one of her characters in that is good looking. But then the other, that's actually the perfect show to watch to solve that, or I guess you
it doesn't solve it. That's
yeah,
the thing.
But it's a perfect example, perfect casting. But yeah, I wanted to bring it up because I feel like I'm alone on the performances in this movie. I just thought it was.
I mean, no, I agree with you. I agree with you, especially with Gabriel Byrne's performance. I was like, what do you like? Talk about sleepwalking through a movie. Like, he just seemed to be part of the furniture almost. Like, what's the point?
Yeah, but I understand his choices. If there was an hour of his performance cut out of the movie, you know, it would have had a little bit more of an impact on a minute-by-minute basis. I mean, he was just being subtle and providing some realism, I think, to a movie that didn't really have much.
That character has been done worse. We've certainly seen it. You know, it's a very easy character to make one-dimensional. But, you know, there was something missing there. Anything about him, you know, I guess, you know, everything, a lot of this movie is from Toni Collette's perspective. So they're not going to cut away to what, Gabriel Byrne's character is going through at a different point, but that's something maybe we needed to see at some point to understand, you know, his viewpoint with all of this and how he's dealing with all the death and tragedy in this family. And, you know, instead we just get this, like, you know, quiet, grieving father that, you know, we don't really care all that much. I sort of welcomed his death. Like I said, I don't usually read a lot of reviews, but I did this time because it has an 87 on Metacritic, and I walked out of this movie thinking it was bad. And I wanted to kind of explore that thought. So something that came to mind, and this is going to make me sound a whole lot smarter than I actually am, but you guys may have heard of this psychological experiment before, where you basically have a group in a room, and everybody agrees, there's three different sized lines on a chalkboard, and everybody agrees that the shortest one is actually the longest. They agree to say that.
Yeah.
And then a third party comes into the room, and kind of naturally you start to bring up the question of which one of these lines is the longest. And everybody says that the short one is. And then that third party is unable to admit which one is actually the longest and tell the truth. They're convinced by everyone else in the room. The reason that came to mind is because I've always kind of had this idea that critics are like a band of brothers and, like, just follow each other, you know, down whatever path they're going. And I feel like that's happening with this movie. Like I said before, I feel like people are getting suckered by some good filmmaking, and then, like, it just kind of snowballs and everybody's giving it a great review. And I just wonder what you guys think about that. Does that exist? Do you feel like it happened here?
Well, I feel like it also depends on the timing of the release. Like, a lot of these, I'm not sure if this movie did, but a lot of these movies, and I'm pretty sure this one would have been released early for critics to...
Well, it was a big Sundance hit.
Yeah, to review. So, yeah, I mean, because it doesn't come out, because all these critics don't watch it at the exact same time and then write their reviews, I mean, there is a staggering. So there could be some influence and bias based on, well, they're like, you know, maybe they read other reviews and then sort of snowball off of that. It's definitely possible.
I just think, you know, we've been doing this podcast again for a few months, and I think more often than not, we reveal three different opinions on a movie. Like, a lot of times, in this movie, I don't think is particularly the case, but a lot of times one of us likes it a lot, someone sort of in the middle, and somebody else didn't like it. I feel like we've sort of fallen into that a lot. And, you know, if we are going to be a small example of how critics think about a movie, then you'd think that would happen more often. You'd think there would be more average scores on movies, you know, excluding the really great ones and the really horrible ones. And yet you seem to have this, like, you know, like I said, a band of critical brothers, just like everybody giving a thumbs up.
You're absolutely right. It happens, I think, a lot during award season, where a movie will come out and then it will be praised and it will sort of be universally loved, and then you go see it and it's kind of okay. I mean, I liked this movie. I think it was good for what it was, but I think there's a couple things going on here. One, I agree with you, Lee. I think people, when someone says something's good, it tends to sort of, if you go into a movie with the knowledge that somebody you respect likes this movie, you're probably going to look for things that are, you know, respectful about it, right? Or that are good. And you're going to give it a little bit more leeway to let it work. But I think also, you know, we have this, there's this idea of these aggregate sites. You know, I think the three of us prefer Metacritic because it's a little bit more mathematical and I think accurate than Rotten Tomatoes. But the idea that I think the way that they aggregate these scores, a lot of times it's whoever the editors are at Metacritic or Rotten Tomatoes sort of guessing as to what, you know, between 1 and 100 these critics would say about, you know, would rate these movies.
That's true, because, like, they have to read the article and then they give it a score based on their interpretation of reading or what they think the critic feels. That is interesting. So,
yeah. And so, like, they, I mean, I read A.O. Scott's review. That's the one review I read, and I'm looking at it right now, and they had A.O. Scott giving it an 80, which is below the average that the movie that the movie is at. It's at 87.
But still really good.
It's still really good, yeah. And I don't, I wouldn't interpret that review that way. And I also think there's another factor in that, like, and it, this may not be the case for A.O. Scott, but like for one of these newspapers, newspaper reviewers, or one of the 48 that they take reviews from every week, these people
are
seeing. Yeah, right. These people are seeing, you know, five movies every week, or, you know, whatever it is, a couple movies every week. And so they see all the awful horror movies, the sort of the repetitive, the same thing over and over again. And so when a movie comes out that does it a little bit differently, they're going to be like, holy shit, this is great. Like, they, you know, they're going to give it its due. And I think, I mean, in a lot of ways that makes sense. Like, a lot of ways, this is a better movie than the average horror movie. I think, you know, it's moving, like we said about Annihilation, it was what I said about Annihilation. It's moving in the right direction. It may not be executed to be a, you know, a transcendent movie, as I said, but it is the tools, he's using the tools correctly. He's using the tools in a way that is original and a little bit more inventive than the average horror movie, than your average, you know, Purge movie, which seems to come out every year and they're the same scares. So, like, they have a different opinion. And I think maybe that's where we can have a little bit of a unique opinion. We're giving our, you know, we're critiquing movies, but we're not seeing every movie. We're not seeing, you know, five movies a week, and we're not seeing everything, so that we still have some semblance of what a great movie is. We can kind of compare these things and be a little tougher on them, which I don't think is a bad thing.
It's funny yeah. You brought that up, because that was we had that same discussion on episode 87 or whatever, when we talked about Foxcatcher, which was a movie that came to mind, actually, when we were saying, like, that's a movie that got swept up with great reviews in the award season. I don't think in the end it actually ended up getting nominated or winning anything, but it was getting all these great reviews, really high Metascore, and we didn't like it at all, and we were sort of asking that same question, and you brought up that, like, you know, the critics see all the shit, like... You know, and then a movie rolls around that's got some good filmmaking or is something unique and different, even if it's for, you know, 2/3 of the movie, and it gets credit for that, which is fair. You know,
yeah, I was gonna say, do you think it should not? I mean,
I think in some cases I'd rather have, you know, two thirds of a really good movie with a, you know, the final third just being total shit. Versus, you know, an entire movie that's mediocre, you know, and that could be argued with, you know, movie to movie. I don't think that's hard and fast, but you know what I mean? Like, I think you got to give it credit for the good parts that it has. You know, I had a hard time doing that with Hereditary, but, you know, I think you're right, Chapin, that, you know, their standards are lower, I guess, as a result of what they have to see.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if this was the Purge podcast. What we'd be saying. I mean,
we love it. It's like,
yeah, I mean, we
10 times
we
have, better than Hereditary.
We have the luxury of saying, like, let's go see this because it's been well reviewed and it seems interesting to us. We don't say, like, oh, we're gonna go see the Purge year one because, you know, it's what's out this week.
Right.
All right, should we move on to a discussion of horror films? Lee, you said you had a great question for us.
Yeah, I already asked it.
Yeah, oh. that was
about the critics. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, okay. I have a question for you guys. Have either of you guys seen It Follows?
No.
I did. Yes.
Wait. I don't think so.
Yeah, it was the one about it was kind of like a allegory for STDs.
A little bit. I mean, yeah. I think yeah. I really like that movie. I think that's an example of I would love to see horror movies go in that direction.
It was a good one. But did either of you guys see The Babadook, which I feel like is a good comparison to Hereditary? Almost.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was much more effective, and it landed at the end. It was what Hereditary almost could have been, at least towards the end of the movie. I almost give Hereditary more credit for its engagement level through the first 2/3 of it, but I think The Babadook was more frightening, legitimately frightening, and it landed at the end. What do you think, Javen?
Yes. No, I know that there is a significant ending to that movie, but I don't remember what it was. I think that, like, that it like they kind of coexist with the monster? Is that the idea?
Yeah, from what I remember, it was like, all right, well, yeah, we're both here. This is how it is moving forward.
So yeah, that was a rookie director as well. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a good one to compare with Hereditary, but yeah, it's been a couple of years since I've seen it, but I do remember that having that sort of impactful horror feeling that I want to get from when I go to sit down to a horror movie.
Yeah, I mean, it is similar to Hereditary in the sense that you're sort of watching family problems then manifest themselves or result from kind of horror elements, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I think that's always an interesting way to explore things that kind of harkens back to The Exorcist and movies of that genre. And I like that because it sort of elevates the horror above just jump scares in that they are sort of psychologically disturbing.
Yeah, and those type of themes are always interesting in horror movies, and they almost take on a deeper meaning, especially when it comes to families and just the relationships between families.
And I think, well, it's a similar idea of what we talked about with the sci-fi genre, that like and you're setting these types of movies in some reality and things become relatable. And like, especially it's especially hard when you're dealing with, you know, the supernatural and things like that, that, you know, whether or not you want to believe is reality is hard to set in reality because it's not something that people have experienced necessarily. But, you know, trying to create this family drama, going through, you know, grieving, you know, death and things like that, that they were going with in Hereditary works. And I think that's why, you know, that movie is, you could stick with that movie for a lot of it because you could always fall back on, you know, you understand what this character must be going through. How must this character be feeling? And, you know, I think that when you're exploring that theme, you know, you get into the psyche of the characters' heads and it's effective.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about the horror genre in general is that it is a like a ripe area for interesting filmmaking in the sense that they are generally pretty inexpensive to make. So there isn't a whole lot of, like, for example, it looks like It Follows was like $1 million or $2 million. The Babadook was like $2 million. Hereditary was $10
yeah,
million, but
Hereditary
still
had
like,
a decent budget, yeah.
Even on that level, it's not, you know, one of these, it doesn't have to make a ton of money to, you know, recoup its costs. And so it can be more experimental, more interesting. It doesn't have to appeal to such a wide audience, although often they do. And so I think, and also that kind of low budget filmmaking, as we've discussed before, kind of inherently encourages creativity. And that's why this genre has always intrigued me. I mean, I'm not like a big horror fan by any means. I kind of, you know, put my nose up a little bit at the genre. But it's just like, it's a playing field that I think is, can be very interesting for that reason. And I'm always like on the lookout for these kind of movies and you know, that where they really are able to do these amazing things because they can within this setting. And, you know, it's hard to find those sort of transcendent movies, but sometimes you see them.
Yeah. I was wondering, like, speaking of the themes and sort of the symbolism and what all the stuff represents, what did you guys take from the whole dollhouse motif?
That's a great question.
Because I really, again, this is another example of where this movie's like, pay attention to me, pay attention, something's going on here with because Toni Collette's character basically builds these dollhouses. And then they start to become to be representative of all the horrible things that are happening in and around her life.
And yeah, the first shot, the opening shot is...
Yeah, it goes from the dollhouse into real life.
Yeah.
So obviously as an audience member, you're like, okay, something, this is interesting. I got to pay attention to this. And it sort of, again, sticks into your psyche. But for me, I never got, and I don't need a clean payoff, but I never got sort of what the filmmaker was ultimately trying to communicate with that.
Yeah, I tried. I really was trying to uncover what they were doing with that, and it's there. I believe that it's there somewhere, that the tie-in between the miniatures that she works on and the story.
Maybe it's on that cutting room floor.
Yeah, honestly, it could be. I mean, and granted, you know, I think he made the right choice. I don't think any of us wanted Hereditary to be a 3-hour-plus movie. But maybe he cut the wrong thing. Could have cut out the last 30 minutes and kept 30 minutes of the other elements. But, yeah, I couldn't find it. I don't have an answer for you. I don't know what that was doing. Okay, all right, we're just going to take a minute to plug ourselves. It's our favorite part of the show. We want to encourage everybody to check us out on our socials at Get Your Film Fix Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. You can also always check us out and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play Music. That certainly is helpful if you rate us and review us there. And you can email us at feedback@getyourfilmfixpodcast.com. We received a really nice email from a listener last week. That not in a very nice way called out Jeremy on his opinion on The Shape of Water. Read a little
what
bit
do you
mean of it.
Called
here.
Me out. Who is this?
They called you out.
I'll read a little bit of it, and Jeremy, if you want to defend yourself real quickly, you
sure.
are welcome to it.
Yeah.
So the listener writes, Jeremy brought up the use of silence in The Shape of Water, and I believe referred to it as a fetishization of silence in the film. What struck me when watching the film was that the theme of silence wasn't so much a fetishization, but rather symbolism of who the characters are, especially at this point in American society, who didn't have a voice. This film is about outsiders fighting against the powers that be and who have very little power themselves in society. In that sense, I thought the use of silence, while perhaps on the nose, as you guys may say, was rather well done.
Yeah, I don't disagree with our brilliant emailer, but I also don't think I was wrong in saying that it was maybe a little bit of both. I think Michael Shannon's character certainly fetishized. Wow, that's a hard word to say now.
Yeah, it is. Read it a couple times.
Silence in the movie, and he represented sort of the society, the white male. So you can take it for both angles. So for him, I would say, yeah, he fetishizes that sort of thing that is looked on by typical society back then as inappropriate. And it also, silence also represents in the same way the other side of it, the minority that aren't able to speak at the time. I think it works on both those levels.
Okay, so we'd like to thank those who emailed us and encourage everybody to send us feedback. It's always fun to hear from people, especially oftentimes even if you disagree. I think it's more interesting. It creates a dynamic that sometimes perhaps we miss if we all agree.
And we'll read it. We'll read it on the air.
We get so many. We have to pick which ones we read,
yeah,
of course.
We'll pick and choose.
Check us out on iTunes, Google Play Music, getyourfilmfixpodcast.com, wherever you listen to your podcasts, and continue to let us know what you think.
Hi.
Where were you?
Nowhere.
Shut up. Where were you? You see that little slut girl you see? Cheryl? Cheryl Lynn?
Don't say that.
Make you feel like a stud to see trash like that? Is she your girlfriend?
No, she's not my girl.
She's a little whore and a little piece of trash. And I know you're not the only one she sees.
What? Why would you say something like that?
I heard things about her and that girl. Don't think I don't know what goes on here when I'm not here. I wash your sheets. I know she's been here. Or are you doing something else in there with your music and your posters on the wall?
What is your problem?
Okay, fine. All right. Just go. Go. Go to that little whore, Cheryl. Why don't you just go to her? Go to your little girlfriend.
Yeah, well, maybe I will.
Yeah?
Yeah?
Yeah? What are you gonna do?
I don't know. I'll do something.
You can't do anything. You're a loser. You'll always be a loser. You couldn't even finish high school because you were so stupid. So what are you going to do?
I'll do something. I'll do it. You know what? I'll go somewhere and I'll do something. Maybe I'll run away where you can never find me.
Go ahead. Fuck that little girl.
All right. So this week we have a top five in honor of Hereditary. We're doing top five worst parents because Toni Collette's character certainly has some issues within her family. So I thought it would be a good idea to do worst parents. I think we've done worst families or most dysfunctional families in the past, but now we get to the specifics of parents that are pretty screwed up. So
you think we're going to have a lot of crossovers here?
We could. I'm calling this my Home Alone memorial list.
That's a good.
That's sort of the quintessential parents that screwed up. I mean, they don't do nearly as bad stuff as the other people on my list, but without them screwing up, we don't have a plot to a movie.
No.
All right. That being said, I don't really have any other criteria. I mean, it could be a mother, it could be a father. It doesn't have to be both parents for me. Actually, I don't think I have any where it's both parents. That would be a tough top five. I don't even know if that top five exists. How about you guys? Do you have any criteria?
Yeah, I tried to. There was a few things I tried to avoid. I tried to avoid villains. You know, people that you would characterize as villains in movies. I also avoided just neglectful parents. Like, just that was the only thing. Like, they had to be worse than just neglectful. And I avoided I guess Home Alone would fall into this category where they're parents that, like, do love and care about their children. They just screw up. Like, I tried to avoid that, too. So, like, these are bad parents by definition, but not necessarily to the extent where they're villains or in the movie. So those were my criteria.
Yeah, I just, I had the same sort of thing. I just made them. I think you could go down the rabbit hole here and have some terrible, terrible parents for different reasons. But I chose each one of my picks is terrible for a different reason.
Okay.
And so I will tell those when I go over them.
All right. Well, I guess I can kick it off. So my number five is Earl Partridge, played by Jason Robards in Magnolia.
That's an excellent pick. I was considering that. My only concern with that was that of that movie filled with a lot of bad parents, you don't actually witness what he does wrong.
Yeah, you don't
hear about
it. Yeah, but you hear about it, and it's the regret of it that fuels that character's last, you know, moments. It's a big part of who that. It's the biggest part of who that character is the regret, and a lot of that has to do with his parenting to Tom Cruise's character.
Yeah, I considered Philip Baker Hall in Magnolia as well, since he may have molested his daughter.
right.
But honorable mention. All right, so my number five, going with a little bit of a fun pick here, I suppose. This movie came up a lot on... lists of worst parents, but I'm not going with the parent that was listed oftentimes. It's from American Pie, but not Eugene Levy. I think he's a great dad.
Yeah, he's fine in that. I don't understand why he's a bad parent.
The bad parent in this one, I am giving the credit to Stifler's mom.
Oh, I think he's the best parent.
Not to Stifler.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
that's like the worst thing that he could do. So I think... That's
a good pick.
But, you know, we all liked her, but, you know, Stifler certainly didn't like what she was up to.
All right. My number five is, I hope I'm pronouncing this name right, Earline Fitzgerald, and she is the mother of Maggie Fitzgerald from Million Dollar Baby.
Oh, I thought about that, yeah.
She comes in and kind of, you know, after a lot of success from Maggie, Million Dollar Baby Fitzgerald, and a lot of money, and I think she buys her a house or something, she doesn't seem at all impressed. She just is awful to her daughter and...
Makushla.
Yeah. What is that what is that? I don't remember
it's
that.
It's like a Gaelic thing, and he tells her what it means. I forget, though.
Oh.
Forget what it means. discover it when we do our Eastwood retrospective.
But yeah, I mean, as far as a parent goes, you know, she's just sort of disengaged. She's like, just someone you could never please.
Well, she gets pissed that she bought her a house too. Yeah. Because she's like, now I won't get my welfare check.
Ungrateful.
All right. So my number four, I actually chose a foreign film. So.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. You're so.
Foreign cinema is real cinema too.
So it's from the 2014 film Force Majeure. I don't know if you guys saw that movie.
I've always wanted to.
Yeah, it's about an avalanche that hits this nice ski resort, and the father there, his name's Thomas. Don't ask me to pronounce the actor's name. When the avalanche hits, he freaks out and leaves his family behind. But everybody's fine after, and he has to live with the ramifications of having left his wife and children to die in an avalanche that didn't kill him. So there you go, my number four pick.
Okay, my number four. While I considered making this my Martin Scorsese memorial list, I decided not to and go with The Wolf of Wall Street for my number four. Jordan Belfort is a pretty horrible parent.
Yeah, I've always... Scorsese's so interesting when it comes to this, because even back when I was in film school, I wrote a paper. I almost said an article, but nobody would have published it. A paper on Scorsese and his how he deals with children in his films. Because everything from Raging Bull to Goodfellas to Wolf of Wall Street, all that, like, children play second fiddle to these people, to their parents, to their families, which is something that seems disengaging almost, because even if you're a gangster or Jordan Belfort, you're gonna have some engagement with your children on more of a level than Scorsese always presents.
Yeah, and I thought about that. Wolf of Wall Street has some scenes where you actually see him putting his kids in danger and everything. So I felt like it was among the Scorsese movies, and like you mentioned, it, you know, the kids are always neglected, to us, whether it's cinematically or actually by their parents.
Yeah, there's always like one scene in which like he shows the kids crying, or like, but like those kids, that would be a bigger part of that story.
Yeah.
All right, my number four is Jeffrey the Big Lebowski from The Big Lebowski. He's very vain, as we find out, and has blown through all of his money, and he doesn't seem to care much for his kids, and he's kind of spending all their inheritance on sort of cheap thrills.
What?
I don't remember this.
Yeah, I mean, remember you find out from Maude that he's like blown through all the money.
But what are the cheap thrills he's...
Well, Tara Reid. He buys that ridiculous house.
I just remember what's his like group of kids called?
The Little Lebowski Achievers.
Yeah,
like Achievers or whatever.
Yeah, the Lebowski Little Achievers or something. Yeah.
So, but I mean, you can imagine what kind of father he'd be. He thinks he's this, or he positions himself as this, you know, self-made man, and of course he's not. The money was mother's, as we find out. And yeah, he's terrible to his kids.
You took a deep dive into this movie that like
This is a brilliant pick, and you guys will I will be vindicated.
Feedback at Get Your Film Picks
podcast.
that podcast just makes the email just that much harder to send.
We would have got so many emails, but they started writing. They're like, forget about it. I'm not going to write the word podcast. All right, who's up?
You are.
Great.
All right, so my number three, and it came up on a bunch of lists, but it was actually the first one I thought of when I thought of this idea, and it's Carrie's mom in the movie Carrie. Have you guys seen that recently or ever?
I have never seen it.
Yeah, she's like super religious, and like demanding as a result.
Yeah, she's a pretty terrible parent, and it does not end well for her daughter. And doesn't end well for her either.
Or any of her schoolmates.
Yeah, it's rough, and she's just specifically just a very rough mother to be around.
All right, so my number four, gonna go the documentary route. I don't know the name of the parent in this movie. I don't remember, and I couldn't find it, but it is Dear Zachary.
The kid's mom
that supposedly kills the father before the baby is born, and the grandparents try to kind of figure out or attend the court case and figure out what happened and try to get custody of the baby. But that's a pretty really horrible good pick. Mother, and she's that, real.
That movie is one of those where... I'd love to revisit it, but I wouldn't, you know, it's just, right. it's
a depressing movie,
it's a rough one to sit through. It's like, this can't get any worse. And then it gets worse. That's a good pick.
You guys talk a lot about the movie. I still haven't seen it. I don't really want to.
Yeah. It's not one of those movies that like, oh yes, tonight's the night I'm going to watch Dear Zachary.
Okay. My number three is a movie I really loved when it came out, but we don't really talk about it a lot. And it's Noah Baumbach's The Squid and the Whale, and it's Bernard Berkman.
Oh, that's a great pick.
Who is played by Jeff Daniels. He's kind of like a failing novelist, and I guess his wife, I'm sort of rereading the plot here, his wife becomes much more popular than he is, and he's very like, you know, erudite and thinks a lot of himself and is very critical of his kids, and it seems very self-involved. And I think, like, I don't know, Lee, you can probably speak to this better than all of us, but what I've sort of noticed between you and some of the new parents who I know is you do sort of have to get rid of everything selfish about your life. And I think that's what makes a great parent, is someone who cares, you know, first and foremost about their kids. And this guy is just selfish and self-involved and obsessed with himself. And so...
That was my 5B that I went with American Pie over.
Yeah, brilliant.
Not sure if I should have. That's a great movie. I had a hard time with that one because, like, for some reason I felt like it didn't fit my criteria, because, you know, I feel like he did love his kids. He just wasn't really good at showing it, or like he only showed it in his own way. I thought a little too hard about it, but It's definitely a good pick, and that's such a good performance too by Jeff Daniels in that movie.
So good.
All right, so I'm gonna go with for my number two pick is Holly Hunter in Raising Arizona. Although technically they weren't, or the baby wasn't her kid. She had some mothering issues in that.
You could have gone with either one of them in that.
I could have. Like. That might have been the only one I could have got parents in. Yeah, exactly. You know, kidnapping a baby because you want to be a mother so bad is not a great way to start off that relationship.
Yeah, I want to see that movie again.
That's two Coen brother movies too that we've had.
Yeah.
Wait, what was the other one we had?
Big Lebowski.
Oh, that's right. Forgettable pick. All right, my number two, going about as pretentious as one can go on a top five, I am going with Francois Truffaut's The 400 Blows.
Yes!
that's great.
I mean, his stepfather calls the police on him and sends him to jail overnight. His mother's just hates him and sends him to a school where she doesn't ever have to see him. They're always arguing in front of him. Like, no wonder this kid ran away. Pretty awful parents.
Did you have to IMDb what it was about?
Actually, that was one of the... the two things I actually remember about that... Actually, there's three things I remember about that movie. The last shot.
Yeah, of course.
The shot with the broken mirror. And... then I remember that his parents hated him. And, like, other than that, for a movie that I just remember really liking.
No, it's a good pull, and it's nice to actually talk about it in a legit way.
Right. Yeah.
where it's not just a reference to a movie that we all know as pretentious and snobby and film schooly.
Okay, my so number two is
earn some listeners with that.
Oh yeah, definitely
from the French New Wave.
My number two is a pretty obvious pick, but it's Daniel Plainview from There Will Be Blood. You know, he's a
cadet.
It's sort of inexplicable. It's still inexplicable why he adopted the kid. Yeah. Maybe that's the one, you know, redeemable thing about Daniel Plainview. But
no, he did it use him basically to get gigs.
That's true. I mean, I think there is some legitimate love there that we do see, but ultimately he does the worst possible thing you can do to a kid, short of molest or kill them, and kind of
tell him he's a bastard.
Disowns him. And kind of reveals that character is probably more evil than good. And so that's my number two.
Yeah, it's an honorable mention for me, for sure.
So There Will Be Blood on a top five.
With 400 blows.
So we've had now two PTA movies.
Yeah.
All right, so my number one is also... a classic, so we can add this to the list, but it is Noah Cross, played by John Huston, in Chinatown.
Yeah, he was a villain for me. That's why I left him off, but he was obviously came to mind. I mean,
yeah, I mean, obviously he's I mean, we won't get into it, but he does not treat his daughter / granddaughter / daughter very well, and it's sort of revealing his evilness is sort of the end bit of the movie. I mean, in that performance is just so good. I mean, I know John Huston's more known as a director, but like, he just, there's something about his voice and the way he carries himself in that movie that you just you get that sense of both evil and like, there, here's a guy that just his whole life he's never like he's able to win almost all the battles he's ever been engaged with. I don't know. There's just I think that's one of the better performances in film history that sort of goes under the radar.
Mm.
Chinatown, I think, oddly goes under the radar. Maybe that's just I don't think anybody like doesn't give it credit, but I feel like it's a movie for some reason that doesn't come up when you're talking about the great movies of the 70s.
I don't know. I feel like it, I mean, it definitely comes up when you're talking about, you know, best screenplays ever written and stuff like that. So it's up there.
All right. My number one, right? We're on number ones. Yes. My number one is a relatively recent movie, last decade or so, Gone Baby Gone, Amy Ryan. In Gone Baby Gone, and she certainly could just be defined as neglectful, but it goes beyond that. She's a horrible mother.
Amy Ryan had a very interesting career, because after Gone Baby Gone, we thought thought she was going to be like a Oscar darling, and then I don't know, where she did The Office for a while, and then, which is a totally different thing, and now you don't see her that much.
She was in The Wire, a couple seasons of The Wire. That might have been before Gone Baby Gone.
Yeah, I think that was before Gone Baby Gone.
Oh, no, it's a good it was after it. But either way, looking at it, she was in Birdman. I don't even remember her in that.
Yeah, who is she in that?
She's got a lot of credits.
She's the Birdman.
Nothing too memorable.
She's in The Post, right? Oh, no, she's in Bridge of Spies.
But yeah, I thought, I mean, she was obviously great in that movie, and she's a terrible mother. That end scene, where for some inexplicable reason, Casey Affleck is babysitting, and she's leaving, you realize.
I love that end scene. I love that end scene.
I do too. I'm favorite. Just looking back, I'm trying to remember why he, was doing that, but,
Yeah, cause he just felt some kind of connection to her and.
Yeah, I guess so. Get, you know, maybe 400 blows was more suited for my number one, but I felt like if I put it at one, it would have been way too much. Been a pretentious overload.
Yeah. My number one is Old Nick from Room.
Took me a second. Yeah.
That recent movie?
With Brie Larson. Yeah, that's a great one.
So not only did he abduct the child's mother, raped her, and then kept the kid, I assume the kid gave birth, she gave birth in that room, and then kept him locked up for the first 5 years of his life. So that's not a great parent.
No. I was disappointed in that movie, unfortunately.
Well, thanks for listening to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We have more to come in the future, and one of those is going to be a very special 4th of July podcast about Steven Spielberg's classic Jaws. We'll probably be drinking some Narragansett beers, crushing them, and doing a podcast.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.